Hi, everybody. Without further ado, let's bring you up to speed. This is part two of the three-part series on the Great Locomotive Chase. In part one, we took you to 1862 in the midst of the Civil War. 23 Ohio soldiers volunteered for a top-secret mission to follow a Kentucky Union spy into Georgia so they could steal a train called the General. The plan was to take the General on a joyride, destroying telegraph poles, bridges, and railroad tracks along the way and crippling the supply line feeding Confederate troops. You've already met our 23 brave Buckeyes as they donned civilian clothes and spent 4 days walking and traveling through a rainstorm, muddy terrain, and a mountain range to get from their regiment, which was based near Nashville, to Marietta, Georgia. They had to separate and make this journey in pairs or groups of three or four so they wouldn't attract attention, then reassemble in Marietta. Well, along the way, two of our men were forced to enlist in a Confederate regiment when they were spotted by rebel guards wondering why they weren't in fighting uniforms. And two of our raiders missed a critical train to get them into position for the final act. So tonight, we're down to 19 Ohioans and their Kentucky leader, James Andrews, who have all managed to get aboard the General pretending to be passengers. The train has stopped for breakfast at a place called Big Shanty. And now that the passengers have unloaded, our Yankees are getting ready to take the train. Sit back and buckle in. We've got one wild ride ahead. In the early dawn light, James Andrews stepped down from the left side of the train and found a sleeping Confederate encampment of hundreds of tents stretched out before him. He wore dark slacks and a vest under a black coat, his long black beard concealing the scarf beneath his chin. Along with his black stovepipe hat, he looked for all the world like a Southern gentleman. As the train passengers entered the hotel for breakfast on the right side, Andrews took the group's chosen engineer, Will Knight of Wayne County, to the engine, which was deserted, the crew having gone in for a bite as well. Knight uncoupled the train's passenger cars, but the three empty boxcars on the train would be going along for the ride. Then Andrews went back to his men waiting in the passenger car and said, "Well, boys, I guess it's time to go." The men followed their leader to the rear boxcar. Corporal Daniel Dorsey from Fairfield County recalled thinking he had vowed to never take a life unless in self-defense. But with his hand on his revolver now, he knew that if he were confronted, he was prepared to act. The men pulled each other into the boxcar. Incredibly, all of this activity was being done in full view of Confederate sentries, but nobody suspected what they were up to. They looked like they knew what they were doing. In the engine car, Will Knight released the brake and the train lurched forward. Now, inside the hotel, sitting at the dining tables, the General's legitimate train engineer, Jefferson Kane, sat with conductor William Fuller, the tried and true Confederate from Atlanta, who we've already told you will be the hero of the day, from the Southern perspective at least, and their railroad boss, Anthony Murphy, the Irish-born foreman of the Western and Atlantic's Locomotive Division. Murphy looked up from his plate of eggs and grits and saw the train moving. He looked at Fuller. "Someone is running off with your train," he said. Unsurprisingly, nobody was interested in breakfast any longer. Crew and passengers alike raced to the door and watched as half the train took off, speeding northbound. Fuller ran to a guard on duty. "Who took the train?" he demanded. The bewildered sentry said he didn't know, but he described a tall man with a dark beard and a black military overcoat. This made Fuller think maybe the thieves were fugitives from that Confederate encampment in the field. He figured they would run the engine till it ran out of steam a few miles ahead and then abandon it. And when they did, Fuller intended to be there. He took off after the train on foot. Now, the conductor, not the engineer, is responsible for the train, and that's a job he took seriously. As the 26-year-old hoofed it down the tracks, the engineer, Jeff Kane, and the railroad boss, Anthony Murphy, followed him. But behind this trio, the watching crowd literally laughed out loud. People would later describe it as watching a slapstick comedy, three men running on foot after a train that is fleeing before them. William Pittenger, a corporal from Steubenville, sat with his fellow raiders in the dark confines of that last rear boxcar, listening for possible gunfire. When there was nothing but the sound and motion of the train, the men were giddy with relief. Pittenger said, "It was a moment of rapture such as will never return. To seize a train of cars in an enemy's camp surrounded by thousands of soldiers and carry it off without a shot fired or even an angry gesture was a marvelous achievement." But barely had he thought this when they encountered their first unexpected problem. A couple of miles north of Big Shanty, they came upon a group of track hands repairing a switch. The crew's foreman saw the train and checked his watch. He knew what time the general was supposed to be coming through, and this train was early. Even more strange, the train had no passenger cars, and the man visible in the engine was not Jefferson Kane, whom he knew well. Boldly, the general slowed and paused just long enough to ask the workers for some tools. Brazenly, Wilson Brown from Logan County jumped down from the engine and asked one of the workers for a crowbar, which the man promptly gave him. Then the train moved on as if everything that had just happened was perfectly normal. A little beyond that stop, Andrews ordered the train stopped. John M. Scott, a sergeant from Stark County, did his assigned job. He scampered up the telegraph pole, knocked the insulating box to the ground, and his comrades used a small saw to sever the wire. Andrews told his men, "When we've passed one more train, the coast will be all clear for burning the bridges and running on through to Chattanooga. For once, boys, we've got the upper hand on the rebels." Some of the men dragged cross ties onto the track to slow down anyone who might be following them. And they had time to kill. You see, the general needed to stay on schedule, or they would risk running into other trains that were using the one-lane track. Andrews was pretty confident they weren't being followed. There was no locomotive available to the south, and no horse was going to catch up with them through this forested terrain. The real obstacles, he knew, would be ahead. But Andrews was wrong. They were being pursued, though the foot chase by Fuller, Murphy, and Kane wasn't really threatening. Not yet. Because the Ohioans were cutting telegraph wires headed north, messages couldn't be sent forward of the train. But news could still be carried to the south. News of the theft reached Marietta, Georgia. That's where John Porter from Delaware County and Martin Hawkins from Portsmouth were stuck after having overslept and missed the train. Porter later recalled, "Soon everything in Marietta was wild with excitement, and the town was thronged with excited rebels waiting to hear further developments regarding the wild train," as it was termed. Porter and Hawkins decided it was time to return north themselves, and they headed out into the countryside. Now, back at the general, the men reboarded the train. They passed the next depot without stopping, chuckling at the distressed looks of the passengers who were standing there, bags in hand, ready to board. They did it again at the next depot. Andrews decided it was time to take more precautions, and the next time he had the train stopped, he had the men pry up a rail from the tracks, which would surely stop any locomotive in pursuit. Then they continued down a steep slope to a 620-foot bridge span, one of the most important bridges on the line. They were now 20 miles from Big Shanty, but on the other side of the bridge, another unexpected sight. There, on a sidetrack in the morning mist, stood a locomotive, the Yona. This train was not on the schedule because it was owned by a mining company and resting on a sidetrack. But Andrews knew it was still a potential rival. It was already under steam, and it was the General's equal in every way. Milling about the Yona was a small group of men. The General rolled on past without stopping, but not knowing what the train was or its purpose for being there, Will Knight, the Raider's engineer, told Andrews, "We had better destroy that engine and the bridge with it." But Andrews always chose flight over fight whenever possible, and he told Knight to continue on his way. Big Shanty, William Fuller had run nearly 3 miles, even as the sprinkle had turned into a steady rain. But he was not anyone's fool. He had a plan. He knew about the men who were supposed to be working on that switch just a little further ahead. When he reached them, he found them standing about, mouths agape at his arrival, completely confused since the General had already passed them. And now here, running up on his 2 feet, was its conductor. Up until this moment, Fuller was hoping that the train had been taken by men who would just run it till it was out of fuel and then abandon it. But after he learned that the train had stopped and asked for tools, Fuller later would say, "I knew it must be a Yankee trick, and from thenceforward, I doubled my determination." The work crew had a hand car with them, not one of those cars propelled by a seesaw lever. That would have been too easy. It was one that was propelled by long poles, like a boatman in a Venetian gondola, except they didn't have the poles. So Fuller coaxed a couple of men onto the platform, and they pushed the car with their feet against the railroad ties, switching sides when their legs began to throb. Fuller's 2 running companions had finally caught up with him, the engineer Jeff Kane and the railroad boss Anthony Murphy, and they got there just in time to hop on the platform. The hand car came to the sites where telegraph wires had been cut and the cross ties piled on the track. They stopped, moved the tiles, and kept on going. They came across 2 local men with rifles and squeezed them onto the crowded platform of the push car. When they came upon the areas where Andrews' raiders had ripped up the railroad track, they lifted the push car across the gap and kept going. Next, they reached the Yona, that mining company train. Fuller hurried to the crew there, explained that the train that had just come through had been stolen by the Yankees. So Fuller, Kane, and Murphy ditched the handcar, and the Yona's engineer continued the pursuit. They also began picking up some scattered Confederates at the stations they were passing. So there were a couple of dozen men on board that train in no time. Up ahead, the General came to and sailed past a couple more stations and their confused crews and passengers. They didn't stop again until they reached a small stop that is used by trains to pick up wood and water. When the station master got a little inquisitive, after all, he knew the regulars on the route, and these guys were not them. Andrews convincingly told him he was taking a load of ammunition to the rebels in Shiloh. A general had ordered it, and lives hung in the balance. Andrews was so commanding and self-possessed, it was hard not to believe him. Then the train, full of fuel and oil, left the station. The next rail challenge was in Kingston, about 7 miles up the road. There, the general was supposed to wait for a train coming in from Rome before proceeding. And after about a half hour, the train arrived. But the train's engineer explained the general couldn't proceed because an unexpected train was on the way. "Unexpected train?" Andrews asked. He firmly explained he had ammunition destined for the front lines and he needed to get a move on. But that newly arrived engineer said that's not possible because Union General Mitchell had taken Huntsville. The railroad was running extra trains to move people and resources out of the threatened city. Now, Mitchell, if you'll recall from episode 1, is the Ohio commander of the regiment from which all our Ohio raiders came from. He'd taken Huntsville at the time that the Ohioans were making their way to Georgia. Well, the Yanks had no choice but to wait, and it was a painful wait. Remember, there are 16 Ohio soldiers sitting in that rear boxcar. They can't speak or move. They can't let anyone know they're in there. I can only imagine how hot it must have been. After an hour of this, Andrews told Knight to find a way to explain to the men the delay. So Knight walked casually back to the train, leaned against the crack in the doors of the boxcar, tried looking for all the world like he was bored, then whispered into the void, "Boys, we have to wait for a train that is a little behind time, and the folks around are getting mighty uneasy and suspicious. Be ready to jump out if you are called, and let them have it hot and fast." Thankfully, it wasn't necessary. A few minutes later, they heard a train whistle, and the locomotive that they'd been expecting rounded the bend and pulled into the station. Andrews marched up to the men in charge and ordered that the train be taken to the sidetrack immediately and demanded the switch be thrown that would allow the general back on the main line. But the Southerner in charge of the switch was having none of it. He demanded to know what authority allowed Andrews to show up and start bossing everyone around. The ever-confident Andrews simply laughed and said, "I've no time to waste with you, old fellow." Then he walked past him, grabbed the switch keys off its peg, and changed the switch himself. Meanwhile, several miles back, the Southern conductor, Bill Fuller, was leading the chase on that mining company train, the Yona. They stopped at the next two stations just long enough to learn the general had sailed through without pausing. Then they arrived in Kingston. The Yankees had made a proper mess of things here. Because Andrews had ordered trains onto side rails and a couple of more trains had arrived since his departure, there were now four trains at the intersection in a messy tangle. Try to picture those slide puzzles where you have to move various pieces to get every other piece where it ought to be. These trains needed to play a game of that to get facing the right direction in the right order. Things were so snarled, in fact, Fuller realized it would take far too much time to move the various trains to clear a path for the Yona. So instead, he commandeered another train, the William R. Smith. The posse grew here too, with a few militiamen volunteering to get in on the action. Aboard the general, Andrews was feeling the urgency from that long delay back in Kingston. "Push her, boys," he told his engine crew. "Let her do her best." They stopped a couple of times to sever more telegraph wires and throw cross ties onto the track to obstruct potential followers, but they pushed at full speed between stops. Andrews' men convinced him the cross ties were only temporary stops. The only thing to really delay a chase train would be to take out another railroad tie. Andrews agreed. Keep in mind, They only have the one iron crowbar, which they'd taken way back when they met that working crew outside Big Shanty. Lifting a rail, which is fastened by great spikes driven into solid oak ties, is no small effort. The men got to work, trying to pry a portion of the track up, when they heard a sound they'd been dreading. The faint but unmistakable sound of a whistle from the south. With newfound adrenaline, the Ohio soldiers lifted the track as if their lives depended on it and snapped the rail, then jumped back aboard the general. At the next stop, Adairsville, the Yanks came across the next train they expected to see, the Texas, a long stretch of a train with 21 cars. Andrews had his northbound train pulled up on a sidetrack next to the Texas, which was facing south on the main line. Both of them were supposed to stay there in a holding pattern because a fast passenger train was coming in and it had the right of way. But Andrews knew they couldn't wait. They'd heard the whistle of that posse in the distance. Andrews repeated for the conductor of the Texas the story about his ammunition mission and that the troops couldn't wait. He needed the Texas to move off the main line so they could continue. Andrews, as usual, was quite convincing. The conductor told Andrews, "Get through by all means, but you will have to run very slow and put a flagman out at every curve or you will have a collision." So the Texas moved away, and the general moved on. Now, this was extremely dangerous. The conductor was not wrong. The general would likely be caught in a game of chicken with that passenger train unless they traveled slow enough to warn it. But Andrews did not slow down, nor put out a flagman. There was no time. All he allowed for was for the general's whistle to be blown almost continuously as a warning to anything ahead. It was Andrews' hope that they could get to the next station before the passenger train even left it. Back in the boxcar, the soldiers felt every bit of the speed they were racing. Daniel Dorsey later wrote, "Sometimes it seemed that our car was off the track or literally jumping along. We were tossed from side to side, almost like beans in a gourd." The general did not beat the passenger train. That train had just left the depot at Calhoun, and soon enough, they were on a direct course for a collision. As the general laid on its whistle and slowed, the engineer of the passenger train reacted quickly, reversing its engine, then backing up all the way to the station. Andrews was going to have to work some magic here because the people he faced weren't just confused like those at the other stations. These people were downright angry because of his recklessness. And Andrews had to find a way to calm them down enough to see his way, because the only way the general was going to move forward was to get that passenger train to willingly move to a sidetrack. Andrew repeated the story about his important military mission. When the train crew started hemming and hawing like they didn't know whether to believe him, he did what he had been doing all along and simply took charge. "I must press on without delay," he said firmly. "Pull your engine ahead and let me out." The conductor of the passenger train folded. The train cleared the main line, and the general moved on. Now, back south a bit, Bill Fuller and his posse aboard the William R. Smith spotted the track the Yankees had torn up. They squealed to a stop no more than 10 feet from the gap. The men aboard muttered about having to abandon the chase, but Bill Fuller would not. He knew what they didn't, that a train called the Texas should be coming south at any time. So Fuller jumped down off the engine and continued the chase on foot again. Just one other man, the train boss Murphy, joined him. Eventually, the Texas showed up, just as Fuller expected. He hailed the train, explained the situation to the Texas engineer, Pete Bracken, and Bracken agreed to join the chase. He backed the Texas up to the station at Adairsville and unhooked its 21 freight cars on a sidetrack. But there was no turnaround at this station. The Texas was going to have to chase the General backward. So Bracken put the train in reverse, and off they went, northbound. The Texas made up a lot of time, reaching 50 miles per hour in reverse. At the next station, the Texas slowed to a crawl, but never stopped moving. And in its brief trip past that station, Conductor Fuller was able to communicate what had happened, what they were doing, and even convinced another train engineer to follow him with an infantry captain who was at the station with 10 soldiers so they would have help when they caught up to the hooligans. So now there are three trains here. The General, with Andrews and his Ohio Raiders, northernmost on the track. Several miles behind them, the Texas, with the conductor Fuller and the railroad boss Murphy. And now the Catoosa, with a handful of soldiers. Back on the General, Andrews again ordered the train stopped so telegraph lines could be cut and another rail torn up. But just as with the last time they did this, they learned they'd run out of time. They heard the sharp cry of a train whistle and turned to see the locomotive in the distance racing toward them. They couldn't have been more surprised. They couldn't imagine how a train had reached them since the last train on this stretch was the southbound Texas. The men asked Andrews, "Is it time to stand and fight?" "No," he said. He ordered everyone aboard. The one thing they could do was uncouple a boxcar, hoping it would slow down the posse. When the crew on the Texas spotted the General ahead, there was pure elation. It was the first time Conductor Bill Fuller had seen his train since it was stolen back at Big Shanty. The boxcar that had been abandoned by the General wasn't much of an obstacle. Since the Texas was driving backward, they simply coupled it to the rear, which was now the front, and continued the chase, pushing that boxcar ahead of them. The soldiers in the boxcar still attached to the General did what they could to slow down the pursuers. They managed to punch a hole through the boards of the car and threw out cross ties and other debris they had been picking up along the way just for this purpose. It only slowed the Texas down a bit as the men on that train jumped out to remove it. In the engine of the General, Andrews was instructing his crew to cram every combustible they could lay their hands on into the furnace to keep the steam engine pumping. The train sped along at a frightful speed. They knew this couldn't last. They soon came to another wooden water station near Tilton, and even though they could see the black puffs of smoke of the train coming after them, they stopped long enough for the soldiers to grab as much wood as they could. But when the Texas came in sight, they had no choice but to leave their task and hop back on the train. At the next station in Dalton, Andrews had to stop the train to check the switch at the Y intersection to make sure they remained headed in the right direction. Then they barreled through the passenger depot without stopping. When the Texas reached Dalton, it only slowed long enough for someone aboard to jump off with a note that Conductor Bill Fuller had hastily written to Brigadier General Danville Ledbetter in Chattanooga. The courier who had jumped off the train ran into the station and tapped out a message on the telegraph. At this very moment, the General had stopped to sever some telegraph wires. So when the Southern courier who had sent the message ahead to Chattanooga received no confirmation it had been received, he had no way of knowing if his message had gotten through. But it had. and General Ledbetter immediately dispatched a company of soldiers on flat cars to meet the approaching Yankees. 11 miles south of Chattanooga, the Confederates stopped, tore up the iron rail so the general would have to stop or derail, then took up positions on the banks of each side of the track. It was the beginning of the end. The general was running out of fuel and water. The soldiers in the boxcar had no more debris to throw on the tracks, and Confederate soldiers had them trapped to the north. Not knowing what was ahead, Andrews had one last play for the posse to the south. He ordered the last boxcar to be set afire on a small bridge. Unfortunately, it was raining pretty good, and it doused what little fire they had been able to start. Andrews drew to him the three men who were in the engine with him and asked what they wanted to do, fight or flee. They decided their best chance of survival was to separate and run, each man on his own. The general managed to rumble past one more station at Ringgold, then pulled around a curve that showed a relentless upgrade. The train would never reach that crest. Andrews gave his final command. "Jump off and scatter, boys," he cried. "Every man for himself." That's it for part two of The Great Locomotive Chase. Come back Sunday for the conclusion. And again, I want to give credit to the details of the story to a 2009 book by Russell S. Bond called Stealing the General. See you Sunday, folks.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.